Hi, I'm Jim Eaves, and you're listening to the Honest Filmmaker podcast, career advice from people in the business. Now, normally I talk to people within filmmaking, but today I'm talking to an author, a published author, Beb Samford. Beb's got 7 books out and more on the way. She's written fiction, non-fiction, and recently contributed to the BBC's Doctor Who Target Book series and I Am the Master. In this chat, we talked about how Bev got published, her tips for getting her work published, how the pay works, what it's like to write for a living, working to a brief, and industry formats. It also features connections between publishing and filmmaking. And of course, we talk about what it's like to write for an iconic character like Doctor Who, how much freedom she had, and how that all worked. Enjoy the chat. If you've got any more questions, pop them in the comments, and make sure you subscribe so you never miss another episode.
So, talk to me about your journey into writing, and by this I mean, how did you get your first book published? Because obviously for people out there, there's a lot of people out there, aspiring writers, I want to get a book published.
Yeah.
How did that happen for you?
Okay, the quickest and easiest way to explain it was that I always wrote anyway, when I was small, but I never really thought about it seriously until I started working for a company called Renaissance, who do a thing called Accelerated Reader, which is quizzing books for schools. Yep. And then when I started working for them, I started thinking, well, I was surrounded by so many great children's books that I thought, I could do this. I really could do this. So then I looked at how I could do it, how you go from having an idea to actually getting something real out there and tangible. And the first thing I did was go to a course called Writing for Children, which was at the City Lit. And I'd never done anything like that before, but it was taught by a really fantastic author called Luke Hensler, who is a published children's author. And that was really good in giving me basically anything I thought I knew about writing, kind of just kicked that straight out the window and taught me some really solid ground rules about how to do it. So that was my first step, I would say, because it made it feel like it was something I could really do. It made it feel within reach. And then somewhere in part of that journey, I was approached by one of the publishers whose books I'd quizzed for this Accelerated Reader Program, a company called Badger. And they were looking for new voices to pitch for a series called Teen Reads, which was my very first book, which actually, when I first met you, that was the book I just had come out. And they were looking for books for what they called struggling or reluctant readers, which are readers who have a reading vocabulary slightly lower than their age, but want to read something good. They don't want to read a book that's not interesting and engaging. So they just gave me a shot. They offered me a shot to pitch because they'd heard of me through other things that I'd done, not published work, but just through actual like working day jobs kind of work. And they gave me a shot of pitching, and I honestly didn't think I'd get anywhere because I wasn't a known author. And they said yes to the first book of mine, so which was quite scary because there's that wonderful build up where you go, oh, someone's offered me a book deal, I've got a contract, but then you actually have to write it, and that's the first scary hurdle, I have to say.
You've got them. They've said yeah, go ahead and write it.
Yeah.
Do they then go to you? It's got to be this many words, or what's, yes, how's so, that process?
And they're very strict with a publisher like that. They're really strict because they only have books of they're this sort of size. But if I hold it that way, you can see they're really, really thin. So I think that was a word count. Don't quote me. I think it's about 5,000 words, which is nothing. I can probably type that in a few tweets. You know what I mean? But when you try and write a book of that size and you're under strict guidelines, you have to follow the treatment that you've given them, you cannot veer away from that. It suddenly becomes like actual work, and you think, what have I done? I can't do it. And you immediately get, I mean, you probably know from script writing, it's you suddenly think, great, here's the idea, brilliant, got the commission. Then you go, oh, I've got to do it. And now I can't do it. Of course I can't do it. I'm a fraud. I can't do it. So that's the biggest kind of thing that I remember from that point, I think, is the getting to that stage and thinking, okay, this is the first step on the journey, as it were. But then it becomes a whole different set of roads and journeys that you have to go on after that, which is the scary part.
Yes, that was that many words. So when I think back to uni, long time ago, years and years and years ago, you know, you'd have 3,000 words would be your final dissertation or whatever, and that seems like an immense amount. And I remember
it's huge, doesn't it?
It does. And I remember my one, I chose Star Trek because the film titles are really long, so yeah. Star Trek, The Search for Spock, eats up a load of words. And if you put the director in it in the year, you know, Star Trek, The Next Generation, Star Trek Generation, Star Trek, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so I got around it that way. And with that first book, did you sign a contract? Did you just, was it
yes,
all done?
So, yes. No, they're really organised because they have to be, because when they organise series like that, they're organising quite a number of books in one go. So I think that one I think there was at least 10 or 12 books. And I think I was the only author that didn't have any other experience in terms of being published. So I had experience as a copywriter and as an editor and all sorts of other things. But I was the only one that hadn't written a book that was being published before. So they took a gamble anyway. But I think with anything like that, they have such a strict timeline, because the books go into schools, so they have to get them ready for the new terms or the new school year. So you have to adhere to it. So it's contract. They'll give you the contract based on the synopsis that you send them, but then they have to run it through things like sales and marketing and all their other departments, which is something you don't even think about when you're first saying, oh yes, brilliant, you've got my book. They have to run it through lots of other channels. It's the same with films. Everyone has to agree. So they give you the contract, they tell you the synopsis is fine, and then you have to stick to it. You really have to. I found out on my third book, I think, that you must not go in that direction with your book. You must stay in the direction that they wanted you to go in, because it messes up all their plans, all their marketing, and all the things they've told the people that are going to buy the books. That's what they're expecting. You know, it's quite strict. It's not awful, but strict. Just strict.
Yeah.
Good discipline.
That's interesting, because people might have this sort of fantasy of, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to sit at home and write a book about something I love, and then a publisher's going to pick it up and it's going to get published and it's going to get edited a little bit, but it's going to come out. This seems like more of a business that you've got.
It is a business, but it's a bit like that first album, isn't it? And your first wonderful film that you did as an indie producer that opens the doors for you. It's the same thing in that it depends entirely on what the book is and who it's for and who the publisher is. Because if you've written, say, I don't know, an adult novel, if you've written it well enough and done your plotting well enough and done your own editing well enough, when it goes to it'll go to your agent first anyway, and then to your editor. If by the time it gets to the publisher, it's in a perfect condition, maybe they won't have to do so much editing. Mm-hmm. But I think something I've seen along the line is what I see is somebody will do their first book and it will be absolutely amazing because they've put all their life into it until that point. And then they'll get to two and three or four and they'll be like, yeah, I can write a book now. And you'll need to do a bit more tweaking, because the first one is always the baby that you've had all this time that you want to put. Well, mostly I find, probably a lot of authors would say different, but that's my experience of editing actually, is that people's first ones are the kind of whole package. And then
And so, putting my ruthless businessman's hat on, so obviously film, we know, indie movies, horror is a good genre. Is there a particular genre that sells in books at the moment, or is it everything, anything?
Books is the same as films. It changes all the time. It changes really fast. There's always when you talk to other authors, there's always kind of the known thing, and I think it's probably the same in film, that you'll say in January, you'll hear that, oh, okay, everyone's looking for indie. I know we talk about this a lot, don't we, about some elevated horrors. Somebody's looking for a new elevated horror that's female-driven. And then by the time you've got your pitch, got your short ready and everything else, by the time it's gone round and spoken to people about it, they've changed their mind, and all of a sudden they want comedies about clowns or something. And publishing is much the same. It goes in cycles all the time, and it changes with, I guess it's the same again in film and television, it changes with the commissioners. So it depends. You might start off pitching an idea to somebody in February who loves your horror idea, and then by August they might have moved on. Mm-hmm. And the person that's come in, this says, well, no, I want books about magic. So it just, so much of it is about timing.
Hmm.
As well, I think.
And you've also, so you do editing, writing, quizzes, I've got down here.
I do everything.
Non-fiction. So why yeah. so many different things?
I think because I don't speak to many other writers about it, but I know that lots of other writers I know come from a background, say, for example, in copywriting. Lots of authors come from a copywriting background, because I think when we want to write, we find a way to write in our careers. If we're lucky, we find a way to make that work for us. And I think when you're an author, because you're self-employed, you never like to give a lot of that stuff up, because books aren't going to make you a fortune unless you're very lucky. So I keep my hand in with everything. So I have a day job as a writer, and then I have being an author is like what I call my evening and weekend job as well. So that's why I do so many different things. And I think you're always having different strings to your bow, and you're always flexing your different, that sounds so cheesy, but you're always flexing your different writing muscles if you're doing different things. I don't think I'd want to do just one genre or just one type of thing. It would be boring.
Yes, I think. Agreed. And
that was a very serious face when I
said
that.
Yeah, yeah, very serious answer as well. And talking about the money, don't have to give me any figures, but how's it
I'm
work?
Living in a mansion, can you tell?
how does it all work?
So for children's books or other books or any books?
So I guess, so with a film, you these days really get an advance, it's all on the back end and you get screwed out of that anyway. So with with books, how does that work? How does payment work?
All right. So with everything that I've done so far, with every book that I've done, I've got, I think my books, eighth and ninth children's book came out last Friday. Yeah. And I've done one other, which is an adult, which is a ghost written book. But they've all worked exactly the same. They've all been advance for half on contract and then half on delivery. So you get your advance. And then some books have royalties and some don't. So it entirely depends. I have found that franchise books, that when you write for franchises, you don't tend to get a royalty. You tend to get a nice advance. And then kind of the payoff is that you've had an opportunity to write for this wonderful franchise. All my other children's books, I get a royalty. The adult, I have to be really careful what I'm saying, the ghost written book that I've done is also the same. It's also royalties as well. So, and the royalty depends on the publisher. It depends on the book. It depends on whether you're a celebrity or not. I'm sure you get a lovely advance. I bet you do.
Although with that advance, I guess that must come with it some pressure. Like, do you not spend the money until it's written, or how do you handle that?
It has to, in theory, I mean, everything's supposed to go straight into our tax accounts, isn't it? Because my tax man comes. In theory, I always look at it that, like, what you're supposed to do is use that money to cover the time for you to write the thing. But when you have a day job, that's just not possible anyway. So it just kind of just goes in and it's part of income. And then, you know, then no advances are that big that you're going to be taking 6 months off. Yet, she says,
yes,
hopefully.
Yes, on the card soon. And then so we know when you deliver a script, courier 12, double space, all that malarkey, single space. is there a particular font you have to use when you submit a book, or is it?
This is what I'm supposed to say, I know, and I'm terrible because the way that I work is slightly chaotic and I do everything at the last minute, which I'll come to if we talk more about writing techniques and stuff, but I'm quite sure that I'm supposed to read through my contracts thoroughly and look to see what they want, but I'm terrible. I literally just write it and then sometimes as an afterthought, I'll go, oh, I wonder if they needed it in 12 point or if they wanted it in courier or whatever. Usually I tend to use the same font, so I'll use something like Times New. I prefer writing in Times New Roman actually because it's nice and clear. But yeah,
how big is your Times Roman? How tiny are you writing?
My vision's not that bad without, you know, with my 20 pairs of glasses on. No, I did in size 12 normally.
Well, yeah, okay. All right, that's interesting. So
then I'm right at the screen like this.
Squinty. Well, now I've got glasses. Yeah. So for somebody who wants to be a writer, and I know you've gone on quite a unique path, do you think, or do you think a lot of people go on that path?
Well, I don't know, I try, and something I've always done is I go to a lot of, well, I used to go to a lot of talks by screenwriters and authors and things like that, because I just genuinely love to hear about other people that are creative and I like to see how they do it, and everybody is different. There's so many different routes, and especially in children's, actually, at the moment there are so many courses you can do. And there are so many things done by publishers that will help you get access to agents and publishing deals and things like that. So there's so many different routes. I think when I first started out, I always thought it was that hopeless thing of just write three chapters, ping them off to an agent or a publisher and hope that someone will pick them off the slush pile. That actually, when I did try and do that, that didn't work for me at all. So that was the thing that I sent out at the time was rejected. It's actually just coming out in a year's time. So it took a long time to come out. But I think most people I speak to, everyone has their own unique route. I think other than people that go and do the obvious courses and things, everyone finds their way in. I do think a commonality is if you're lucky enough to have met other authors, if you start networking the same within the film industry, you can talk to people and find out how they do it. You might get an introduction or at the very least help yourself get on the right path, maybe you're doing things in the right way, I think.
Yeah, but with the caveat, because this is in filmmaking as well, remember that you're not trying to squeeze that person for every piece of information they've got.
No.
Because people like that, it's awful to network.
I hate it. Do you know what? I've never done that. It's funny enough, it's something I never really thought about until I got published, and I'm sure this happens to you with your films. You suddenly find once you have a book out or something that maybe puts you in a position where people perceive you to be slightly elevated in when you're not career-wise, people will just suddenly start asking you things. So I'll get messages from people saying, oh, my partner wants to write a children's book. Can you introduce him over? And I think, I haven't spoken to you for 10 years. It's, and I understand why people do it. But I never did that. So I would have felt terribly awkward about asking any other writers, could you introduce me or can I speak to your publisher? What I always tried to do was just go, I just sort of like to be around that environment to see if it suited me and see if it felt right for me. And the more I hang out with authors and went to a lot of events, especially Doctor Who events, I went to lots of those and just tried to get to know the writers and things just to see if it felt like something that was right for me, if that made sense. And it kind of went through there.
Yeah, no,
it's just about testing the water, isn't it? Same with filmmaking. So I met you guys too.
Yeah, you've got to turn up. You can't just pop up out of nowhere, suck all the information out, and then move on to the next person.
And then disappear.
Which I've actually seen in Cannes. You see it a lot. Someone will come up to you, blah, 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 tell you their pitch. They'll figure out quite quick. Right, with me, maybe it's the opposite. They'll figure out quite quickly that I'm of no use to them. And then they'll just be like, oh. And then just move on to somebody else immediately. That's, you know,
I find it really awkward. And I've been at events, especially screenwriting events and filmmaking events, where people kind of shove their business cards at me and I'll come home with all these cards and think, I don't remember who you are. And then I'll get it, because I'm, especially when I'm anxious, I will talk a lot to people that I don't know very well as a kind of an anxiety buffer. So I'll end up getting emails from people saying, hey, let's meet up and talk about making these films or whatever. And I think, but you're not the people I want to make films with. And I get panicky and I don't reply and I just back off, because it's exactly that thing. It's not, it's quite cold. It's not, it's not a personal thing. It's a career intent. I'm sorry to everybody that I've ever done that to you. I've just offended.
It's an interesting topic, side topic, because it's one that's very transferable between these two.
Absolutely.
Creative industries is networking. What are your tips for networking with people? How do you
honestly be yourself? Because that's kind of what I've always done. I just show up. As you know, you and I and a friend of ours, Pat, met at the London Screenwriters Festival, and I think we just met in the bar, didn't we? So I just always try and talk to people that seem like the kind of people I would like to hang out with. So I like you, I will try and move very, very quickly if it's not the right person for me to talk to. So I will just kind of be myself, go around in my own awkward, loud way and talk to people. And then if I come away with something I've learned that's nice, like it's a nice that that person's working in horror, or it's nice that that person's got a film coming out or something, that's a nice bit of knowledge that I've gained, but it doesn't have to be something personally useful to me. I just kind of like learning about other creatives. So I guess my tip would be to just be genuine and don't try and force things with people, because I think so many creative people, we're quite good at reading people anyway, and we can see straight through it anyway. And it's just awkward, isn't it? It's not.
Yeah,
and you don't. Nobody wants to be around the awkward pusher.
Yeah, and there's a lot of lessons on how to network. But I think maybe steer people into a different version of themselves, because if you are the sort of kid who's comfortable in the corner, talking about dark things, do you know what I mean? If you're that sort of reserved sort of person, then those are the people you should go chat to. You're not. You're forced to be this other version of yourself. So back to the writing.
Yeah.
So something I struggle with when I'm writing a script, writer's block, get to a certain thing, or just laziness. I just get to a certain point, I'm just like, oh my God, I don't know how to get, what do I do? Have you got any tips for that? How do you handle it?
Can I just say, I can't believe for a second that you get writer's block, having read your scripts, which you, on a Monday, you're like, I've got an idea. And then 3 seconds later, there's this amazing script that's fully formed. So I don't know how you're getting around it. But I do get writer's block, and I usually get it if I try and start too soon. So that's what I was saying earlier about technique, is that some people I know will do, they'll say, I don't know, the book's due in December. They'll get the commission in the January beforehand. And they'll spend that whole year plotting and doing whiteboards and scrapbooks and collages and everything. And it will be wonderful. And then they'll be like, I've done a chapter and this, I've done 300 words today and I've done another 300 words. And I think, wow, I wish I could be that organized and do it, but I simply can't. So everything I do is in my head. So I get the idea, I put a bit of it down in a notebook, and then I spend the next however long walking around with it in my head. And I go on long walks and I think about it, or I just sit at home and I procrastinate madly for months and I think about it again. And then the writer's block kicks in, the exact point that I know I have to start writing, which is usually quite soon before deadline. Every publisher I've ever worked with will say, yes, Bev's always just a little bit over deadline or just very close to. I've never delivered early in my life. I doubt I ever will. And so what I do when that happens is you literally just have, it's like anything else that's horrible and tough in life. You have to just do it. You have to fight the fear and do it, because the minute you start typing, even if you're typing absolute rubbish, you're doing something, so it's coming out. So that's the hurdle. So I think I've heard of authors that say they don't believe there is writer's block. I think there is, but I think it's fear. I don't think it's, or the other thing that I used to get told a lot in studying and things like that is that if there's a block in your writing, it might be because something isn't working that you haven't identified yet. So if you come up against the hurdle and then you're saying, oh, well, I can't get to my third act or my last chapter, it might be because you haven't plotted earlier on what should happen at that point. So that good plotting does help for that. I hate plotting, but it does help.
Yeah. And so that, yeah, that reminds me of, I guess, the way I get over writer's block is usually I'll tell Laura what I'm doing and she'll go, oh,
yeah,
don't be silly, this is the way to fix it.
Yes.
So how do you do that with a novel that's like thousands and thousands? Can you get someone to read a bit, or what do you do?
No, I do. My poor partner for donkey's years, he's like my middle of the night call for like writer's block. So I will ring him and say at like 2 a.m, he's a night owl anyway, he's up all night. I will call him and say, I'm stuck because this thing has happened and I can't get to there. And he'll say, well, of course you're going to deliver it because you always do. So he's very good at that. He always knows. It never surprises him that I'll deliver it. So that's reassurance in itself. But he's very good at just seeing straight through it and problem solving and saying, I don't think Laura's probably the same. She'll just say, maybe, I don't know, wasn't that character, just do that thing. And you're like, oh, of course, because it's already in there, but you can't quite get to it until you've vocalized it for somebody else.
Yeah.
I do that as well.
Yeah, so that also happens in the edit. So a previous film, I try not to ruin it, but the lead character kills somebody, and me and Laura were chatting, and I didn't know how to get over that hurdle because I had this whole extended sequence where she got the body, she put it in a suitcase, and then she lifted it into the car, which is impossible, it'd be too heavy, drove out to a cliff and tossed the suitcase off the cliff, and it was all dramatic. And I sort of said to Laura, I said, well, what would you do if you killed me? And she went, oh, I'd bury you in the garden, which is just what we ended up putting in the film. Because it was just like, yeah, of course you would. You'd look out the window and you'd go, I'll just bury it in the garden. You know,
because sometimes you need someone else's logic to just kick in. Yeah.
Yeah. Trying to be too clever and too creative.
Yeah.
So moving on to, one thing I wanted to ask about, and this is something that every filmmaker goes through or hopefully can still go through, because obviously physical media's, is it in, is it out? Everyone's buying LPs now, so maybe it's back. But
I know.
Going into HMV, picking your film up, you know, in a DVD case is a moment. What was that moment like for you with the first book that you sort of found in a shop?
Do you know, it's a funny one, because the first 5 books I did, so until Doctor Who, all of my books were books that were going into schools. So although I had the copies in my hands, which is a weird thing in itself to see your own name on the cover, you're like, really, is that me? It still doesn't feel quite real. And I was just thinking about it on Friday, actually. I'm not sure it ever feels like that moment, because you always feel like a fraud as a creative anyway, I think. I don't think it was until the first Doctor Who, and I went to the signing that I did at Forbidden Planet was my wow moment. Because until then, my books had been in schools, or I'd seen some friends of mine that worked in Waterstones had got copies of those books in Waterstones. But it wasn't until Doctor Who that it was a real book that anybody I knew could go into a shop and find. And that was, I think that was a slightly different moment, because that's when you go from being, okay, yes, I write books, to, yes, but now I write books that you can go and see. They are real. So that makes it realer for you. So I think having a signing at Forbidden Planet with a book that I had contributed to I'm not sure I'll ever top that. That was a moment.
And that was the wow moment. Colin Baker as well, weren't you? You were like How did you finagle that seat? Was that allocated, or were you just like, I'm next to
you? You know what? I can't remember. I think they did it for they did it for us, because there were 4 of us. There was myself, Colin, lovely. He's so lovely. You've worked with Colin, of course, yourself, but he's lovely.
Colin, yeah.
And 2 absolutely incredible writers, Vinnie Patel and Joy Wilkinson, who are amazing. And I really didn't feel like I should be there, because I was the newbie, Doctor Who. But when I arrived, they'd actually already put the little name plates on the desk in front. So I was like, oh, I'm next to Colin. And I think they're thinking, I'm sure it wasn't, but my thinking has always been that they thought there'll be a long queue and everybody will want to get to Colin. So if you put Colin at the end, people aren't going to be, you know, because people are going to want to talk to him for a bit longer, obviously, than us, because he's Colin. They'll have the 2 well-known Doctor Who writers, because they've both written for the TV show for J.D. Whittaker's Doctor, in front of me. And then I'll be the sort of good one in between that can delay people a bit before they get to Colin and after the other two. I felt like I was a bit of a good placeholder for that. Yeah. So I think it was a very good strategy by them. They're a lovely team at Finn and Planet. I think they just thought it was sensible.
Yes, yes. Well, you lucked out that one.
I did luck out. They were very good.
So Doctor Who, that's a big one, because you were a fan before anyway, weren't you?
I've been a fan of Doctor Who since I was born, basically. So my first Doctor was Peter Davison was my Doctor.
Yeah, he was. So talk to me about how that came about.
People always ask that. You know, that's the question I get asked most often by everybody: is how did you get Doctor Who? As if it's like it's such a strange
you've
thing.
You've caught Doctor Who. It's like a butterfly.
I caught it. I caught a Doctor Who, and I've passed it on now. I had always been a fan, as you said, but it was that kind of thing where I'd always thought, of course I'll never write for Doctor Who. But in the back of my head, I always thought, why not? Why couldn't I write for Doctor Who? So for years, I'd actually had on a whiteboard, I've still got it, but I think it's behind all the mess in here. I actually have on a whiteboard a plot for a Doctor Who TV show, which they kind of made not that long ago. So I feel like I was in the right job. Maybe I manifested really well. I had been around Doctor Who people for a while, so I've been going to like the big Finish days, and I've been to some Doctor Who signings and got to know people, but that does not get you a Doctor Who. That's not how that works. It just meant I could understand a bit more about who wrote for it and how the process worked and whether I liked the people that were involved in the writing of Doctor Who and things like that. And I just got really lucky. I knew the editor for the books through because he's also a children's author. And I was on Twitter one day, and I think I wrote something like, I think I was editing a lot of the time, and I wrote something like, I can't wait for the day I can just be working on my own really good new novel rather than always editing other people's, or something like that. And I got this message that said, would you like to pitch Doctor Who idea? And I thought it was a joke. So I was like, oh yeah, go on then. And he said, oh no, can you pitch an idea by like, it was, I think I had like 2 hours or something. And what happened was they were looking, there'd been a slight change with the book, that the first one that I wrote, and they decided to add some more stories to it, and they didn't have someone in mind, and they wanted another, I think they wanted another female author, I'm not quite sure, but I think they just didn't have anyone in mind, and they were looking around and they saw me on Twitter or something and was, oh yeah, that sounds Bev. So I just thought they were kidding, but they weren't. It was just really good timing and luck, I think, and they liked the idea, and it would never have gone to anything if they hadn't liked the idea. So the pitch that I came up with in about 2 seconds was luckily one that, but they gave me the Doctor as well to write for. I didn't have any choice about that. No, I didn't. Yeah. I didn't pick the Doctor. They said for this. They said for Peter Capaldi, and I said, "Oh my God! Out of all the Doctors, he's probably the one I least know about to write for." Just in terms, because he was so new at that point. Still, I couldn't have. I didn't think I could have done it. So I pitched a quick idea, and then they came back and said, "Right, can you come back with a longer pitch?" And I think I had like a day or something to come up with a longer pitch. So I had to go and mainline all of his episodes. I literally took a day off and watched them back to back, felt absolutely in love with him and thought he was wonderful, which really helped with the pitch. And it came from that. And I was quite shocked when they said yes, to be honest, because I just thought they would say no, because I wasn't known at all. So,
but then this comes back to that networking thing, doesn't it? You've met people, there might be people out there who meet this editor of the books and immediately think, I want to do a Doctor Who book. Oh, do you want to see my work? Blah, 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 blah.
Definitely do.
Yeah, they do. So it just shows you there's an element of patience involved and not being transactional with relationships.
Yeah.
With people, other people.
And I think also, because I used to spend, for years, I thought you'd have to be a massive fan of Doctor Who to write for it. But there have definitely been authors that have written for Who that maybe are nowhere near as big of fans as some other people that have written for it and things like that. And it's just about being the right fit for what they need at the time. I think that's always happens with franchises. I think one of the most important things is they have to trust that you will deliver on time, that they can trust you with the project, they can trust you to be true to Doctor Who, which is so much bigger than anything you can write. You're just contributing a tiny little slice to an absolutely enormous cake, for want of a better explanation. So they have to trust that you can do that without kind of messing it up, I think. So I was quite lucky, I think. And because most of my books have been quite small, I think they knew I could deliver a short enough story, on deadline.
On deadline, just about.
On deadline, just about.
And so it is an iconic character. How much say do they have? Like, do they tweak your synopsis, or are they then going back to you with changes?
I don't know what it's like for anyone else, because I've not really spoken to other Doctor Who people about their process, but for me, I was actually quite lucky, because I understand the person that edits, I know their books quite well, so I know how they work. and I like their work. So I kind of already knew how they worked, which helped a bit. But it's quite collaborative. So when you first pitch the ideas, they work with you, like the editor works with you to get it as good as it can be, because then it has to get approved by other people who, you know, the publisher and Doctor Who. I always think there's like a big Doctor Who button or something in a room somewhere that says yes or no, you know, like some X's or something. So there's a few stages it has to go through to make sure it's things like, it doesn't matter how great your story is, if it might interfere with something further down the line in canon that nobody knows yet, and there's all that kind of stuff which you can't even think of. So it's always about having a good story that can pass those hurdles as well, I think. But they're very collaborative, and I think I found that I wasn't edited very much on either of my Doctor Who books. I was really lucky, they both went through pretty quickly.
Awesome.
As well.
And so sci-fi, comic book movies, so Star Wars and Marvel and all that, you've got their own element of toxic fandom. What is Doctor Who fandom like, having come into contact with it?
You know what? I think partly because I'm not particularly well known in Doctor Who world. You know, I've only done two, I'd say I've only done two short stories. You know, obviously many other Doctor Who authors have written lots and lots of Doctor Who books, so they're and for a long time before I came along. So everyone sees all different elements of it, but I've never seen anything other than Doctor Who fans being really lovely, to be honest. I met a few at the signing who were really lovely. I've spoken to some online, but everyone I've ever encountered has been really nice. I'm sure there are toxic elements like any other fan base, but I have never come into contact with them. I've been very lucky, if they're out there.
So just circling back to the writing, what's the worst part of the process? Is it sat with an empty page, or is it the bit when you've handed it over and you're waiting for them to say if they like it or not? Or is it not that simple?
I don't know if it's either of those. It's weird. I think the empty page is just a challenge, isn't it? So although it's a frightening thing, I always know I'm going to do it. I never think I'm not going to, I don't really think I can't do this. I know I can, because of course I can. I've got books to prove it. I don't think it's waiting for them to come back. There's a weird moment when I had this the day when I sent the book in late, obviously, to your publisher. And I suddenly thought I was late on it because I'd realised it didn't work in the way that I wanted it to work. And I had to spend some more time on it. And when I sent it in, I remember thinking this is going to be a hit or miss. It's either going to absolutely work or it's going to not work at all. And that's, I suppose that is the waiting. But I've never had that with any other book other than that one. I think the worst bit honestly is when you've delivered and it's done. And if you don't have anything else coming up, that's the worst bit, because you've come out of the bubble. So you're like, well, what now? Now I've got to do my normal job and nobody wants to write anything with me yet. So I think that's the worst part, because you go into that really happy, I don't know if it happens to you, but I go into that really happy bubble when I'm writing, thinking this is what I'm here to do and I'm having a chance to do it. And when it ends, it's like, oh, you know.
Yeah, mine's usually the shoot's finished, the main shoot's finished, everyone's gone home, and I've got it all on a hard drive in there. Obviously you have a couple of nights of drinking wine and cheersing yourself. It's in the can.
And then you've got to do the rest of the job.
Oh my God, I've got to edit it all, and it's got to be good, and all those people are relying.
And then you have to put it all together. Yeah, because for you, you're doing everything. So you've got to unpick it all and put it back together again.
Yeah.
And when you've already done all that.
What if we didn't get, you know, then you start thinking, did we record that scene? Is the dialogue all right for this? And oh yeah, that's not fun.
Your job is way harder than mine. Much harder.
I wouldn't think about that. You said Peter Davidson was your doctor. Is he your favorite?
He was my
doctor.
Oh, it's really hard because it often changes depending on what I've just watched. But I mean, I was thinking back on this the other day. I can't remember why, but I was just thinking about how. Oh, it's because I was seeing a countdown to a horror book coming out, and one of my first scary Who's was a Peter Davison episode called Black Orchid, which was actually a classic thriller rather than a horror, which had a harlequin in it. Terrified me when I was five. But he was my dreamboat when I was five. I thought I was going to marry him when I got older. I have met him several times. He's lovely. He was my classic doctor, but then Sylvester is... It's really difficult because they change all the time. I think Sylvester's the one I remember the most from that top, from classic Who. He's the one I love the most because I loved his version of the Doctor. Modern Who is really difficult because I would always have said Matt Smith until I rewatched Peter Capaldi. And I think now Peter might be my favourite Doctor of all time. I think, just because he's just astonishing in that role. He's just a joy to watch. And I might be a little bit biased because I've written for him, but he makes me cry when I watch his performances. He's so good at everything.
What are your top three tips for becoming a writer? Not a published writer, just yep. a writer. What are your three top tips?
For how to become a writer, or how to...
How to become
process.
A writer.
So how to become a writer. Books or films?
Books.
Books. Read. You would be amazed how many people that write don't read. And it's not about anything other than you need to read and be around storytelling to understand your own voice and develop your own voice. You need to understand what you like and what you want to read and how your writing should sound. So that's the most important thing. To read all the time to find out. And also to find out what else is out there, you know, because there's nothing worse than writing a book, as happened to me, writing a whole book that you loved and then walking into foils and seeing it on the list in front of you, which is awful. That one, write. Sounds really, really obvious, but write. Get used to writing, because you will find that your writing when you start is very different to the writing that you do 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, and so on. So you need to get into understanding your own voice and what works for you and how you want to tell stories, because a lot of people just don't know. When I've edited people that have come to me and said, oh, I've got this idea for a book, and I say, okay, great, who's it, what's the age group, is it adults, is it children, what kind of genre is it, and they say, I don't know. And if you don't know your craft and, you know, what you're writing about and who you're writing for, that's your first big hurdle, I think. Do you have any other tips? Read. That's right. And develop some resilience, I think, is a really important one. You need to be resilient in any of these creative industries, I think, because you can't give up just when you get a rejection. You can't give up because you've had 200 rejections. You've got to, you know, really strap yourself in and be committed to it, I think, and be resilient, because you're going to get stuff all the time that you don't want to hear. So you have to kind of say, fine, whatever, and stick to what you do. You know?
Which, again, those tips could equally be passed on to filmmaking. Yeah. So instead of reading, you're watching films. Instead of writing, you're making films. And that resilience is so important, because part of being a creative is putting your heart and soul into something, and then somebody else judging it, which can be tough.
Because it's actually your baby. So we have, that's it. That's actually a really important thing, is to learn not to take it personally as well, because it's personal to you, but it's not personal to anybody else. It might resonate with somebody else if you're lucky, but you have to remember that it's your baby. But once it's out of you, once you've birthed it, to sound without wanting to sound, there's another cringy moment. This whole thing is going to be full of cringy moments of mine. It kind of doesn't belong to you, especially once it's published or the film is out there. It almost doesn't belong to you anymore, does it? You're giving it to everyone else. So whatever they think of it. Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Make sure you subscribe to the Honest Filmmaker podcast for more career advice from people in the business.